From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made twice today, 4:30 and 7:30 at the Rochester Academy of Medicine as part of their Nutrition as Medicine lecture series. Now, Dr. Michael Greger's in town, the author of How Not to Die, and he is also the creator of NutritionFacts.org, which you might have seen. We're talking about how not to die, and as I said this morning, we're not talking about things like gargling magma or diving out of a plane without a parachute. We're talking about what we put into our body, and not only what we put into our body, how it can hurt us, but how we can actually maybe even pull back on some of the deleterious effects of what we have been eating. So, nutrition as medicine. Dr. Michael Greger is here, the author of How Not to Die. First of all, it's great to have you in studio, sir. How are you?
So glad to be here. Doing great.
Well, thanks for taking the time for us. And as always, the irrepressible Dr. Ted Barnett is here, who is not only from Rochester Ravs, the Rochester Area Vegan Society. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you.
Which, by the way, it's not Rochester Ravs, it's just Ravs, because that's like TCBY yogurt. I get it. But Ted's also, as of September, the founder of Rochester Lifestyle Medicine. What is that, Ted?
So it's an actual medical group that we've formed with six other physicians and three nurse practitioners, two physician's assistants, a couple of RDs and social workers, and there's over 30 of us, and we've partnered with the Rochester Academy of Medicine. We've renovated offices on the third floor there, and our goal is to teach skills to patients so that they can learn to eat a plant-based diet and learn to exercise and do other health-promoting things without requiring surgery or drugs. And we've got our first 22 patients already started. They started in early February, and we're seeing great results already.
All right. Well, listeners, if you have any questions about plant-based diet, incorporating and making changes in your lifestyle, what you eat, et cetera, you want to talk about the book, you want to talk about Dr. Greger's work, this is your chance to do it this hour. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And before we dive into the book and related issues, Ted, just tell us what's coming up this afternoon and this evening.
So one of the things we've done as partners with the Academy of Medicine is we've started a Nutrition as Medicine lecture series, which we're very excited about. And Dr. Greger, who's here with us now in the studio, will be our kickoff speaker. And that's there are tickets available online at rocklifemed.com. That's rocklifemed.com. There's still tickets available for 4:30 and 7:30. We also are having a dinner with Dr. Greger in the middle, but all the tickets to that have been sold out. But that's okay. You can still hear his lecture this evening. And then in April, we have Dr. Neil Barnard coming, who's the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And then in May, we've got Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn from the Cleveland Clinic talking about reversing heart disease with lifestyle changes. Just going back for a second, Neil Barnard will be talking about the new nutritional approach to type 2 diabetes. And then in June, we have Dr. Campbell coming, who's a local physician and co-author of the China study. And he'll be talking about diet and cancer. Does nutrition matter? And we're going to continue the lecture series in the fall, but we're taking a break for the summer. So
okay, and yeah. If you want to go today, how do they do that, Ted?
You can walk in, you can go over to the Academy, and if there's still tickets available, we'll let you in at the door. It's $15 for the 4:30 lecture and $20 for the 7:30 lecture. We prefer, however, that you'd purchase your tickets online ahead of time. That'll save everybody a lot of time at the door.
Okay.
We're practically sold out now.
Okay. Well, Dr. Greger, when it comes to your work on just looking at the health impacts of what we're putting into our bodies here. You know, you look at the leading causes of death in this country, and everyone gravitates towards, you know, coronary heart disease, and I understand that, and we'll talk about that. What I find so interesting is you even write about suicide. You write about depression. You write about things that we don't immediately associate with that. Why?
You know, that was really the big surprise to me. Was when I was putting together the book, I wanted to have a chapter on each of the 15 leading causes of death. And so, yeah, some of them just follow in naturally. Heart disease, certain cancers, hypertension, type 2 diabetes. But then, you know, suicidal depression is our 10th leading cause of death. And so I was like, well, let's see what's in there. And there actually is a literature, not only kind of observational literature or cohort studies where they take populations and follow them over the time. We know that people who eat healthier also feel healthy, but how do you know what causes with? Maybe people who are mentally healthy go on to eat healthy and not vice versa. What you need are interventional studies where you take people, change their, randomize them into two groups, change half the group's diet and see actually what happens. And that's been done now University of Arizona. We've actually seen that when you remove meat, eggs, fish, dairy, from people's diets, within 2 weeks you can see a significant improvement in mood, and we think that's because of something called arachidonic acid, this inflammatory omega-6 fatty acid found predominantly in chicken and eggs in this country, which they think is causing neuroinflammation, brain inflammation, but we can clear that inflammation from our brains within just 2 weeks, see a significant improvement in mood by cutting down on eggs, chicken, and other meat.
Comedian Louis C.K. said, whether it's cake or big steaks, he says, I don't eat till I'm full. I eat until I hate myself. And you know, he said it in a way that it is funny. I mean, he's a comedian. But he also will say that it's only funny because a lot of people can relate to it. And what you're telling us is that there is a connection that is observable, that it isn't just an idea that eat better food, you'll feel better about yourself. There's an observable difference.
And not only that, but it goes the other way, too. You have to love yourself. You have to care enough about yourself and your family's health to make these changes. To eat differently. I mean, it's, what we eat, it plays such a role in social situations, holidays, family situations. I mean, it's a big shift in one's life. And if it wasn't so important, if it wasn't so life-changing, so life-saving, people wouldn't do it. But when it's a matter of life and death, then it really is worth making these dramatic changes. But why would we do it? We do it because we really care about our futures. We care about ourselves enough that we wouldn't want to put this in our body. We like our car so much, so we change the oil, we put the good gas in. The same thing with our bodies. If we care enough about our bodies, care enough about our family, then we're going to treat them right.
Ted, we've talked about a lot of different impacts on our health when it comes to diet. Suicide and depression was not one of them. Did that stand out to you? What did you make of that connection?
I think that's fascinating. Had not occurred to me before.
Yeah, I find that so interesting. Well, then before I get back to your phone calls, which I see are starting to come in here, for Dr. Greger and Ted Barnett here as we talk about nutrition as medicine, we are seeing an interesting point, and I think a change point, Dr. Greger, when it comes to treating diet as medicine, nutrition as medicine, that is becoming much more accepted by major medical systems, right? When we talked about that, Ted, talked about that with Tom Campbell, among others, that there is more of an acceptance by major medical systems that this can be treating a wide range of different things, as you write about. Do you sense that change? This isn't just, this is a fringe idea. Pick up the book in the corner of the store, and this is becoming more mainstream.
There's really a sea change within industry, within the corporate world, within the insurance industry, because plant-based diets aren't just safer and cheaper, but can work better, can be more effective, because you're actually treating the cause of the disease. And when we do that, we can not only prevent, treat, but even reverse some of these chronic conditions, which would otherwise require surgery or drugs to take every day for the rest of your life, risking side effects, and never really get at treating the cause of the disease. And the vast majority of disease that most primary care physicians see, about 80%, are these chronic diseases. Most of them are lifestyle diseases. But the good news is we have tremendous power, tremendous control over our health, destiny, and longevity. The vast majority of premature death and disability in this country is preventable with a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle behaviors.
Did you grow up with a plant-based diet?
I did not. I'm just new to the plant-based diet 26 years ago.
26 years ago.
26 years ago.
Ted, when did you grow up with a plant-based diet?
No, I
never asked you that question.
No. We made our change about 25 years ago.
All right, so you guys around the same time? Did you call each other? Did you know each other at the time?
No, not at all.
It's roughly the same time. But what you have seen, I would imagine, in 2.5 decades is a lot more opening up of our culture, the options, dining out, et cetera, et cetera. What's different now between today and 26 years ago when it comes to plant-based eating, Dr. Greger?
Oh, well, it's so much more easy, so much more convenient, so much more socially acceptable. What isn't different is the science. We knew the science back then, we knew the science now, and that's the tragedy. So what did it for me was July 1990, when Dr. Dean Ornish published his Lifestyle Heart Trial in the most prestigious medical journal in the world, proving for the first time, there in black and white, something called quantitative angiography, proving that you can open up arteries without drugs, without surgery, effectively the cure to the number one killer of men and women. Since that day, no one else should have died of heart disease, yet hundreds of thousands of people continue to perish from this preventable, treatable, reversible reversible condition. That's the real tragedy. We've had the science, we've had it for decades, yet people continue to die.
And so Dean Ornish was what changed you.
Dean Ornish did what did it for me.
25 years ago, what changed you, Ted?
Dean Ornish.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. We were thinking about making the switch for environmental reasons at the time. And then Dean Ornish's book came out on reversing heart disease. And he talks about how difficult it is to get funding for anything to do with lifestyle. So medical research for lifestyle is not supported by pharmaceutical companies or, you know, the manufacturers of medical equipment. So I had what I call my sloping forehead moment, which is when you can't see that on the radio, but I hit myself on the forehead. Of course, it makes sense. It's like an aha moment, right? You say, well, that makes perfect sense, because all these very expensive things that we use to treat people have a constituency in industry, whereas getting people to eat right has very little constituency. There's no broccoli lobby, really.
Well, and I don't want to derail into something too political, but I do want to ask this, because I know Dr. Greger has mentioned this in prior interviews. You know, I think it bears asking why 25 years later, 26 years later, why is it that this is now starting to take hold? As opposed to, like you said, the day that Dean Ornish came out with this, you thought, okay, the light switch is on. And you have mentioned that in a profit incentivized system, there is less of an incentive for real advocacy for preventive or curative diet like this. In other words, there's more money in status quo. I mean, do you feel that way?
Yeah, although there's certainly still a lot of ignorance now. I mean, doctors have a severe nutrition deficiency in education. I mean, we just weren't taught this in medical school. This whole body of evidence on using lifestyle interventions to reverse
disease. Is that changing? Is that getting better?
I would like to think that, but the last national survey of medical schools here in the country, which I think was 2006, so it's still a little dated now, found that only a quarter of medical schools offer a single dedicated course in nutrition. So if the vast majority of what we're seeing in primary care can be treated with life, you'd think, the Global Burden of Disease study, the Bill and Melinda Gates funded largest study in risk factors in history, found number one killer in the United States are diet, number one cause of disability is our diet. Tobacco smoking only kills about 500,000 Americans a year. Our diet kills hundreds of thousands more. So, of course, that's the number one thing we learn about in medical school, right? And no, we don't. I mean, you know, ask your doctor last time they were taken out to dinner by Big Broccoli. Probably been a while. I mean, this is, you know, it's a big pharma plays a role in medical education and practice. There's certainly time, there's reimbursement barriers. Oftentimes doctors are just not paid to, you know, teach people how to take better care of themselves. That's why I'm so excited about what Dr. Barnett is doing here in Rochester, really leading the way. And hope that communities around the country will see the model here and be able to incorporate in their communities.
Nationwide, is there a better system that we should go to? I know our listeners, and they're saying, would this change with something like single payer?
Well, single payer will give access. I mean, that's the most important thing, is that finally we would have universal access, truly universal access. There wouldn't be millions of people continuing to be underinsured in this country. And so under a, you know, Bernie Sanders type administration. But again, what kind of medicine would they have access to? Would they have access to cardiac stenting and bypass surgery, which actually doesn't extend lifespan? So would they just have more access to this kind of these techno fixes as opposed to these kind of treat the cause interventions? So really, it's just like when I complain that doctors aren't getting enough nutrition education. Well, if the nutrition education they're getting is from the National Dairy Board and the Cattlemen's Association, then maybe it's good that they're not getting any nutrition information and they're getting their nutrition information from the checkout aisle at the grocery store, from the magazines rather than from the scientific literature. People need to realize the tremendous power that doctors are missing, this powerful tool lacking from their medical toolbox that can actually make the difference for these chronic diseases, which as physicians are very frustrating to treat. Our patients don't get better. They get worse and worse. We can slow down their diabetes. We can slow down their blindness and their amputations and their kidney failure. That's kind of the best case scenario, slowing the progression of disease. But here's a tool where you can actually reverse the course of disease. And so I think when many doctors hear about this, so for example, I'm giving grand rounds at the hospital here tomorrow morning, and when many doctors hear about that, it reignites the spark that they had, the reason they went to medical school in the first place. You know, if people wanted to make money, they'd go to the stock market or something. People go into medicine because they want to take care of people. And yet, it's very frustrating to treat people with the current bevy of chronic disease that we're seeing in primary care. But for the first time, you can show them the data saying, what? We can turn diabetes around? We can, you know, I don't have to just keep piling on hypertension meds. We can actually cure. I mean, this is really, I mean, you see their kind of eyes light up, and that's why they went into medical school. They want to make people healthy, and here we're offering a tool for them to do that.
Heart disease. Can you turn it around?
You can absolutely turn it around. Something we've known for 26 years. We can prevent heart disease, treat heart disease, and reverse heart disease. 80% of patients see this reversal of heart disease, opening up arteries, literally without drugs, without surgery. Our bodies are able to dissolve this plaque away, this atherosclerotic plaque, this hardening of the arteries, which is what closes, kind of squeezes down the blood supply to our heart muscle. Same thing happens in our brain, which can lead to a stroke. This is a disease that need not occur if we treat ourselves right. And what's so surprising is that when researchers took people with heart disease, put them on the kind of diet followed by populations that did not get heart disease, their hope was that we could just slow the disease down, maybe even stop it. But instead, something miraculous happened. They were able to turn these around, suggesting their bodies wanted to be healthy all along, but were just never given the chance.
But that's one thing for if you're 40 or if someone is 55 and has had heart disease or signs of trouble. I'm thinking of someone I know who's 83, who just had a valve replacement, who has had a number of ailments and has been a meat-eating, meat's been part of his diet his whole life, with some routine, probably some protein meat every day. 83. Change in diet could have an impact even at that age, or is it sort of too late?
So it depends what kind of heart disease. Certain types of valvular heart disease have to do with infections,
sure,
or things that may not actually be diet-related or lifestyle-related. But if it's coronary heart disease, if it's because of atherosclerosis, then indeed we can reverse the course of the disease. We can.
There's no time that's too late for that.
It's never too late to start eating healthier, to stop smoking, or to start exercising.
Okay. Ted, what do you tell people on that?
I agree with that. And actually, going back to your question about who pays, whether we had single payer, whether that would matter. I decided a couple of years ago to not even get into the argument about who's paying, because it's very political, and I think people have a hard time agreeing. But to me, what matters so much is, why does it cost so much? Why are we spending so much on healthcare? There are estimates that as much as 80% of what we spend on healthcare is related to dietary and lifestyle habits. So let's pretend it's just 50% that we could actually get rid of. That would be amazing. And if I had a drug, I said, well, we can cut, if everyone took this drug, we could cut down the health expenses by 5 or 6%. People would say, wow, that's great. Everyone should take it. Well, we're talking here as much as 80%, and it doesn't matter who's paying for it. It would be fantastic if we could get people to just stop making themselves sick with their diet. As Caldwell Esselstyn said, heart disease is a foodborne illness.
All right. Well, listeners, we're going to get to your phone calls. If you want to call the program, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Dr. Michael Greger is here. He is the author of How Not to Die. Dr. Ted Barnett is here from Rochester Lifestyle Medicine. And Dr. Greger's in town here in Rochester as a guest of RAVS,
right.
Rochester Area Vegan Society, and the Rochester Academy of Medicine, where he's speaking both today at 4:30 and 7:30, and they say they've got a few tickets still available, and that's at 1441 East Avenue. Bud in Chilai, first up. Go ahead, Bud.
Hi. I'd like to ask a question about the prevalence of high fructose corn syrup in foods that we can buy, and secondly, how is the high fructose corn syrup metabolized by the liver, and is that similar to the way alcohol is metabolized in the liver?
That is an accurate assessment. Yes, indeed. High fructose corn syrup, there's two types of so-called industrial sugars, table sugar, high fructose corn syrup, both of which associated with increased risk of hypertension, obesity, and fatty liver disease. And part of that fatty liver disease, when you think of fatty liver disease, you think of alcoholic fatty liver disease, but there's a non-alcoholic fatty liver disease caused by increased kind of overconsumption of calories and fructose in particular, which can lead to the buildup of fat in the liver, which is typically asymptomatic, but sometimes can trigger inflammation, some so-called fatty hepatitis, which can lead to cirrhosis, liver cancer, or even death. So it's important for us to cut down on added sugars in our diet.
Bud, does that help?
Well, I'm just wondering, are they aware how prevalent high fructose corn syrup is in processed foods?
It's very prevalent, and one of the reasons is because taxpayers subsidize it. Our tax dollars go to the sugar industry, go to corn and soy to make animal feed cheaper, instead of subsidizing the foods we really need. Why aren't we, if we're going to be subsidizing foods, let's subsidize fruits and vegetables. So, for example, a number of European countries have free fruit programs for kids. The kids walk into school and they have a piece of fruit on their desk that's paid for by the government because they know it's that kind of food that's actually going to save the government in the long run in terms of health care costs.
Every phone line's lit up. Let's just keep going down the line here with phone calls for Drs. Greger and Barnett here. And this is Al in Rochester. Next up, go ahead, Al. Hi, Al. Go ahead.
Can the plaque that's built up in a person's arteries, Can that plaque be reduced by proper eating?
The plaque can absolutely be reduced. Now, the most particularly the most dangerous plaque, once plaque has been around for a long time, can get calcified and hardened. That plaque may not go away, but you don't worry about that plaque. The plaque that you're concerned about is this unstable plaque, this little cauldron of inflammation which can burst, causing a blood clot to form, and that's what triggers so-called myocardial infarctions or heart attacks. And so, and that's the plaque that we can actually pull the cholesterol out of that plaque, reduce its likelihood of rupture, thereby significantly decreasing the risk of so-called cardiovascular events, things like heart attacks, sudden cardiac death, and strokes.
Yeah, just to reinforce that, what Michael's talking about is the difference between old hard plaques and fresh soft plaques. And it's the fresh soft plaques that actually don't cause angina. So the older hard plaques occupy enough of the cross-section of the artery so that when you try to exercise, your heart muscle is deprived of blood and oxygen, and you develop chest pain or angina. That's because you're not getting enough blood flow out there. However, that doesn't cause a heart attack. What causes a heart attack is one of these soft plaques that is not big enough to actually cause angina. When it suddenly ruptures and the whole vessel downstream from there clots off, and suddenly you have a whole area of myocardium that's not getting any blood flow, and those are the ones that kill people. And Michael's right. The soft plaques can be stabilized and reduced by eating a proper diet, and the hard plaques will regress somewhat. That's what we see on angiograms, that they do improve somewhat. And the thing to remember is that even a slight improvement in the cross-section of the vessel causes a huge improvement in blood flow because it varies as r to the fourth power of the radius. So even a little bit of change will cause a tremendous increase in blood flow. And it can happen in weeks if you change your diet.
Al, does that help?
Yeah, that's it. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Al. Thanks for the phone call. Next up, in Pittsburgh, this is Tim. Tim is kind of the hammer of skepticism for the show.
Oh, stop. I haven't even said anything yet. I have a serious question.
Yeah, go ahead.
I run ultra marathons, so 50K, 50-mile-plus races. Ooh. And in spring and summer, my mileage is up over 100 miles a week, and I need a pretty large amount of protein, and if I was to be on a vegetable-based diet, how do I get that without having to eat 8,000 beans and spend a ton of money on that protein, which is really good for recovery?
So stay on the line, Tim. It's a great question. And by the way, I said the hammer of skepticism with some affection there. I think that's he plays.
Yeah.
It's an affectionate term. Dr. Greger, why don't you start? Go ahead.
Yeah, so the protein requirements for endurance athletes is really only about 15% higher than what the Institute of Medicine recommends for everyone, which is 0.8 grams per healthy kilogram body weight. And you can get that without even thinking about it, just because of the increased caloric intake. So if you're, I mean, if you're getting enough calories to kind of support that kind of intensive workout, you're eating a variety of whole plant foods, you are by definition, by default, getting all the protein you need. In fact, you're probably getting 2-3 times.
From what source? What are the sources?
And so the plant. I mean, anyone who doesn't know how to get protein on a plant-based diet. Don't know beans. And indeed, beans, legumes, beans, split peas, chickpeas, and lentils are the plant kingdom superstars when it comes to protein, but lots of protein. Whole grains, there's also some nuts and seeds. Vegetables, basically, all food has protein. They all have complete proteins, with the exception of gelatin, which is animal protein. And so protein is not something one need worry about getting enough of unless one is on a severely calorie-restricted diet. If someone's trying to lose a lot of weight and not eating enough food, they can become protein and if they're living off of junk food and lettuce or something, but shouldn't be a problem.
Ted, what do you tell people on this?
Pretty much what Michael just said. Instead of thinking in terms of grams of protein, I try to have people think in terms of percent calories from protein. So as Michael said, if you're getting enough food, and as long as it's whole food, if you're getting enough food, you will get enough protein. Beans are a great source of protein, but basically protein is found in all food. Even a potato is 10% calories from protein. Broccoli is 44% calories from protein. Kale is 30% calories from protein. Beans are actually only about 20 to 30% calories from protein. The reason we think of them as a great source of protein, which they are, is because they're calorically dense. So it's a great way to just to get enough food in you. You couldn't get enough calories, certainly not as an ultramarathoner, by eating broccoli. It would just take too much. But there are some endurance athletes like Scott Jurek, who is a vegan, and you can
I know about him.
You're not familiar with him?
I'm definitely familiar.
Oh, you are
Jurek,
familiar. Yeah, yeah. So, see what he has to say on the subject. And you know, for the most part, protein is not an issue unless you're living on junk food. You know, soda and chips. So,
all right. Thanks, guys. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Thanks very much, Tim. Ultramarathon. That's hardcore.
Well, you know, the original ultramarathoners, the Tarahumara Indians, who did these 150-mile at a time, 48-hour constant races, this was a plant-based population. They ate almost exclusively plant foods.
48 hours?
48 hours nonstop, 150-mile races for fun, kicking a ball. I mean, this was...
That sounds like a lot of fun.
And barefoot, right?
And they're barefoot, and they're doing it on, you know, eating corns and beans, you know, corn, beans, and vegetables, squash, yeah.
All right. So, in other words, it does sound like this is a common question, though. Ted, I think we've had this before when you've been on, people asking about protein, beans, but there's a lot more protein, I think, in common foods than we may realize.
If you're getting enough calories, you will get enough protein if you're eating whole foods.
Okay. John in Branchport. Go ahead, John.
Evan, first of all, great show.
Oh, thanks.
And thank you. And it's a follow-up to your show with Dr. Campbell last summer that got me turned around. The information that your guests are talking about is very solid. It's been around for a long time. I got three issues I'd like them to comment on briefly. Number one, primary care doctors don't have the time. They already said about training, but they don't have the time to spend with patients talking about this. Two, nutritionists in Rochester aren't even familiar with this. They're in kind of the old school nutrition. And three, the drug companies and insurance companies have no incentive to do this. They want you to go in and see your doctor quickly, get some drugs, have surgery, blah, blah, blah. And I'm talking as a former heart patient. So I'll hang up and listen to the response on the air. Thank you very much.
Yeah, John, thanks for calling from Branchport. Appreciate that. Well, Dr. Barnett, you want to start there? What
do
you think?
Sure. That's a great question. You're right. Clinicians, primary care clinicians, don't have a lot of time to spend with their patients. And so it is easier for them to prescribe medication. Not that they necessarily want to do that, but that's the world they find themselves in, which is why I started this company last fall called Rochester Lifestyle Medicine, and we incorporated that. And we are, if you didn't hear at the beginning, we have 6 other doctors that are working with me, some nurse practitioners, PAs, and the idea is that we are going to provide patients with that attention that they need. Because you're right, 15 minutes is not enough time. It takes hours, days, weeks, and in fact, our program, if you sign up, is a whole year. The first 9 weeks is an intensive lifestyle modification program, where you meet twice a week and you have 2 hours. During which time you watch standardized videos, because there's 18 standardized videos in the curriculum that we use. followed by a group discussion, and then small group discussions as well. We also have one-on-one meetings with our providers that last. The first one's an hour, the second, and after that, they're half an hour, and there's six of those during the year. So you're right. It's in order for people to change their lives, they really, really need time. For one thing, to actually believe that it's going to work, because the culture around us tells us this is crazy, this isn't going to work, and yet once patients start to do it, they are amazed. For example, we have one patient. Our first group of patients, we just started the first group in February 2nd. They're 5 weeks in, and one patient's cholesterol is down 65 points. He's lost 26 pounds, and this is just on diet. And what happens is patients come in on medications. They have to actually reduce or eliminate their medications because your blood pressure can become dangerously low if you're still on blood pressure medication. So you have to get off those. So we work in close cooperation with the patient's physicians. We don't manage their medication. We have them managed by their personal physician. So that was the time issue. As far as RDs and the nutritionists in the area knowing about this, there are some dietitians that I have worked with who are actually aware of this. Two of them work on my team with the Rochester Lifestyle Medicine team. And there's some, I know of two over at Unity Hospital who are fabulous. You know, Joy Valvano, who's actually been on the show in the past, and she's totally on board with this. So, yeah, people are coming around as far as that goes. And I think you'll also find that the younger people going into, becoming registered dietitians, they are definitely aware of this. And, of course, they meet resistance from their professors, but that's okay. That's how professors learn. So,
But let me ask Dr. Greger here, because, you know, you mentioned earlier, we're still, as an American medical system, we're not prioritizing nutrition in general. Fair to say, right?
Fair to say.
Okay. Because there's people like Ted, and we're seeing some shifts, but we're not, writ large, we're not seeing it prioritized in the way that you think we should. And I'm thinking of, well, if the system's not going to change, if people feel like I don't have a lot of time with my doctor, which is a common complaint and understandable, can't doctors have, at the very least, literature to hand out ready to go? I can't talk to you for half an hour about your diet, but here, I've got this for you. I mean, at the very least, could that start to change it?
There are some wonderful resources out now. In fact, there are some insurance companies like Kaiser Permanente now has a plant-based brochure that they can hand to patients. There are wonderful resources like the 21daykickstart.org, which starts, it's a free program. Hundreds of thousands of people go through it. It's in a bunch of languages. First of every month, you sign up. You get free daily recipes and tips. And you do it as a kind of a social group online. I'm going to offer support and really kind of get you. And look, you could write that on a script, 21daykickstart.org. Again, it's entirely free. There's no excuse why a physician can't at least point people to that path. And when it comes to safe, simple, side-effect-free solutions like quitting smoking, you don't need your doctor to tell you that or start eating healthier, right? We can take the power into our own hands. In fact, that's how I started this. I mean, when I saw this disconnect between the science and medical practice, I went around and speaking in medical schools. I actually traveled around the country with the goal of speaking at all 127 medical schools every 2 years. To catch this whole new generation of doctors and tell them about these powerful tools. And then I realized, wait a second, I don't need to convince the doctors to convince patients. When it comes to something this simple, this safe, this effective, I can go straight to the people and say, look. And so that's why I started the website, nutritionfacts.org, really to get this word out to the millions, and that now there's this democratization of information. Before, doctors were the gatekeepers for information about health. And so all the tobacco industries had to do is pay off the AMA, and they could kind of control the message. No longer can big pharma and big food control the message. Now we can learn about this ourselves. And there's a lot of garbage on the internet, but one's hope is that the truth will eventually kind of float to the surface, and we have decades of solid science and the peer-reviewed medical literature supporting these powerful interventional approaches.
And you can read a lot more in Dr. Greger's new book. It's called How Not to Die, and he's in town with the Rochester Academy of Medicine for two events today, 4:30 and 7:30. That's on East Avenue at the Rochester Academy of Medicine. We're going to get a short break and more of your phone calls. Dan, Sarah, we're coming to you next. We've got some online comments, questions. Michael, among others, who have sent in their comments as well. We'll get to those with Dr. Greger and Dr. Ted Barnett from the Rochester Area Vegan Society and Rochester Lifestyle Medicine. The conversation continues in a moment on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Rochester is part of the Rose Fellowship 2016. That means we're working with three other cities, Denver, Long Beach, and Birmingham, to solve similar problems. And we'll talk about how these cities are doing that in the first hour. Then second hour, editing. How editing can change the psychology of filmmaking. Fun discussion there. Hope you join us. We'll talk with you Tuesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Rochester Regional Health's Sands Constellation Heart Institute, with offices at Rochester General and Unity Hospitals, Brighton, Greece, Geneva, Dansville, Geneseo, and now Linden Oaks Medical Campus. For information, call 585-442-5320.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Michael emails the program and just wants a quick clarification. He says, hi, Evan. Did your guest say that 80% of healthcare costs come from diet and lifestyle? Could he explain that a bit more? Dr. Greger?
So 80% of our healthcare dollar in primary care are these chronic diseases, most of which are indeed lifestyle diseases. So we're talking about heart disease, type 2 diabetes, hypertension. These are the diseases that one typically sees. So the most common doctor visit in the country is actually blood pressure checks. They're coming in, getting their blood pressure checked in a controlled setting and seeing if we need to, you know, switch around drugs. And so that's, and because these medications, because these are diseases caused by lifestyle, and if you use medications to basically prevent some of the predictable consequences of these chronic conditions, you have to be on these medications every day for the rest of life. So they are a bonanza for the pharmaceutical industry. You know, that's why we don't see new antibiotics. Take antibiotics for 10 days. I mean, where the money is are these these lifestyle, because people, you know, we're unfortunately treating these diseases as if they're like medication deficiency diseases as opposed to lifestyle diseases. And if you don't change the lifestyle, unfortunately, you're never getting at the root cause.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones. And Dan in Pittsburgh is next up. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah. Good afternoon, doctor. I've got a question. There is a proliferation of GMOs into our food system, including a lot of plant-based foods. Any thoughts about GMOs at all?
The largest concern about GMOs is increased pesticide residues on GMO soy. So I encourage people. Now, most GMO soy is actually animal feed, not actually in the kind of soy foods one finds in the market. But by choosing organic, by the 2002 USDA standards, one, by definition, it's non-GMO soy. And so one can decrease one's exposure to pesticide residues by choosing organic soy products.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for the phone call. Sarah in Ithaca. Next up. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi. I wanted to ask about how much a difference cutting out dairy and eggs makes. We don't eat a lot of eggs, but a fair amount. We don't eat meat at all. We do eat quite a lot of cheese because, well, it's so delicious. I was really intrigued by what you said about chicken and eggs contributing to depression, because it's a problem for both my daughter and I. I'm on medication and I'm fine, but we're having trouble figuring out how to get her more balanced.
Sarah, thanks for the phone call. Why don't you hang in there on the line and let Dr. Greger start with dairy and eggs. Go ahead.
So the number one source of saturated fat in the country is not kind of steak or red meat, which one might think, but actually dairy. So number one, source of saturated fat in the diet is dairy. Number two is actually chicken. Number two is actually poultry, in terms of where saturated fat is mostly coming from, which increases our cholesterol. Number one kind of, you know, conventional risk factor for a leading killer of both men and women. And eggs are the number one source of dietary cholesterol by far, constituting about a quarter of America's cholesterol intake. And so if one's trying to cut down on the three things that increase cholesterol, saturated fat, trans fats, and cholesterol, cutting out dairy and eggs would be the primary ways to cut down on two of those, and then getting rid of processed foods. Anything with partially hydrogenated oils and getting rid of deep-fried foods in restaurants would bring down the trans fats intake. So those, cutting down on those three things would be the best route to dropping one's cholesterol down, which should decrease one's risk of dying from the number one killer.
Okay. So you want to follow up there, Sarah? Go ahead.
We don't have cholesterol problems in our family. In fact, my sister is a nurse, and she told me that eggs are actually really quite important for children, especially children who don't eat meat. And she said eating eggs is a cutting out eggs as a cholesterol problem really only matters if you have a cholesterol problem. And I was also worried, wanted to know a little bit more about how can you test for the connection to depression? Does the test just stop eating eggs for 2 weeks?
Okay, so on let's take the first one first. Sorry. Kids, sure. Especially kids who don't eat meat,
right.
Do they need eggs?
Absolutely do not need eggs. In fact, having a normal, many people, you know, come there, look, I have a normal cholesterol. But look, having a normal cholesterol in a society where it's normal to drop dead of a heart attack, our number one killer, not necessarily a good thing, right? Just like having normal blood pressure. This whole 140 over 90 cutoff is arbitrary. We now have evidence that even people with blood pressure 120 over 80, you went to your doctor with a blood pressure 120 over 80, you get a gold star. But now we have evidence even people under 120 over 80 benefit from blood pressure reduction. So having an ideal blood pressure... Mm-hmm. The no benefit from reducing it further blood pressure is really down by 110 over 70. So being in a normal bell curve in a society that's dropping dead from chronic disease, not necessarily a good thing. And for kids in particular, we want to get them started on a path of eating healthier. And so whatever one was thinking that the egg was good for, whether it's protein, a healthier source of protein, source of protein that includes all sorts of other good things like fiber and folate and potassium, would be legumes, you know, hummus, things like that, bean soups, lentils. These are the healthiest foods,
right,
for growth, for protein. And then in terms of depression, because these interventional studies show such remarkable benefits in so short a time, it can take drugs like Prozac months to take an effect. Within just 2 weeks, a significant improvement in mood. So what I would encourage you to do is give it a try, like a free trial. You know, just look. I mean, people have difficulty wrapping their heads around, you know, lifestyle changes. Oh, never going to have pepperoni pizza again or something. But no. I encourage my patients, look, give it a try. Like, just a few weeks, right? You can do anything for three. Give it a few weeks, and then you can see your numbers get better. You can see your digestion get better, your sleep get better, your energy get better. And then the motivation to continue eating healthy comes from within, comes from the joy of living, rather than, you know, taking some pill every day for the rest of your life because of, you know, fear of dying or kind of this fear-based approach. No, you just feel so much better. And so that alone, and then, you know, people are often running, and that can also, that's the most sustainable way to continue this. So I encourage people, give it a try and see how you feel.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks for the phone call and good luck to you. We're talking to Dr. Michael Greger, whose book is How Not to Die. He is in Rochester today, alongside Dr. Ted Barnett from Rochester Lifestyle Medicine. And when it comes to moderation, we always, you know, I spent years in the commercial television news industry, and it felt like, you know, I had a colleague who said every other week we get a study that says, well, now even blueberries is a problem. And now this is, are you even everything? And he would say even moderation in moderation. But when it comes to moderation, take meat, for example. Beef in moderation, okay or not okay, Dr. Greger?
Well, so for example, when it comes to the worst of the worst processed meat, the World Health Organization's IARC, the official body that determines what is and is not cancer-causing, came out recently identifying processed meat, which is ham, hot dogs, lunch meats, nuggets, things that we feed our children. These are class 1 carcinogens. Processed meat is a class 1 carcinogen, meaning we are as sure that processed meat causes cancer as we are that asbestos and cigarette smoke causes cancer. So now that we know these foods cause cancer, how are they allowed in the federal school lunch program? Why are we still feeding those? Now, red meat is still a class 2 carcinogen, a probable human carcinogen. Still wouldn't want to feed it to my children.
So hold on. Processed was class 1.
Class 1. So it's the highest class. And so it is a known human carcinogen.
Okay.
And so the question is, how much is okay?
Yeah.
Well, look, when, you know, I tell my smoking patients, don't cut down from 2 packs a day to 1/2 pack a day. I tell them to quit. Now, it's now some people are social smokers. They can pick up a cigarette once or twice at a party their whole year. You know, is there data to suggest that that's harmful rather than completely not smoking? No. But the reason we don't tell people that smoking once in a while is okay is because we're afraid of the slippery slope. Once they get back, then they're going to go down to a smoking habit. And so I think psychologically it's easier for people to follow these simple rules. And so really... asking a diabetic to make, you know, moderate changes in diet can leave them with moderate blindness, moderate kidney failure, moderate amputation, maybe just a few toes or something. I mean, this is not, you know, everything in moderation is not necessarily a good thing.
Okay, and red meat you said is class 2, but for you,
so it's a probable human carcinogen. Okay, do you want to give a probable human carcinogen to people you love? I mean, that's just, you know, how much? And there's people argue, well, yeah, but the increased cancer risk, colon cancer or something, you know, is only, you know, 20%. Okay, well, what level of cancer is okay? You know, I mean, if there's a modifiable risk factor, something we can do about it. Look, there's some things we don't have control over. We may not have control over the air pollution levels or the radon levels. There's certain things that increase cancer risk that we have less control over. But look, diet, we can choose what to put in our mouth. Most of us can. And if we have control over diets, we can reduce our risk for chronic disease.
All right. Pat writes to us from Rush. Starts by saying, thank you for your tremendous show. Pat, flattery will get you nowhere. Besides everywhere. And Pat says, please ask Dr. Greger and Dr. Barnett how one can obtain adequate vitamin B12 from a plant-based diet.
Fantastic question. There are two vitamins that are not made by plants. One is made by our skin when it's exposed to sun. It's not really a vitamin. It's a hormone called vitamin D. Unfortunately, up here at Rochester, no matter how long you sunbathe naked out here by the lake, you're not going to make enough vitamin D because the sun's rays are at such an angle. So during the winter months at this latitude, it's important that people supplement their diet with vitamin D. I recommend 2,000 international units of vitamin D a day. And the other vitamin not made by plants is vitamin B12. Not made by animals either, made by little microbes that blanket the earth. So we used to get all the B12 we needed drinking out of mountain, stream, or well water, but now we chlorinate our water supply to kill off any bacteria. So we don't get a lot of B12 in our water anymore. Don't get a lot of cholera either. That's a good thing. But because the way we live in our sanitized world, we need to get a source of vitamin B12. Our fellow great apes get it from eating bugs, dirt, and feces, but I prefer vitamin B12 supplements. So I encourage people eating healthy plant-based diets to take one 2,500 microgram supplement of vitamin B12 once a week. Costs less than $5 a year. You'll get all the B12 you need.
Okay. John writes to us and says, Evan, great show today. As a mental health and addiction counselor, I've had talks with clients about nutrition. I get a lot of resistance due to the cost of food, especially for Medicaid clients. How can I address this?
Tough question. And honestly, I don't really have an answer to that other than we can tell people what we think they should be eating. If there's a problem in the culture at large about how expensive healthy food is, that's a problem. Michael talked earlier about how the subsidies are in our country. We subsidize the meat, dairy, and grains, and basically make unhealthy food out of that. That's why unhealthy food tends to be cheap. Healthy food tends to be expensive because we're not subsidizing it. So, you know, there are some local resources, the Good Food Cooperative, that type of thing.
Food Link,
right. So I'm not, I have to say, I'm not really all that familiar with that, how to go about doing that on a budget.
Okay.
Some of the cheapest foods are some of the healthiest foods. So dried beans and peas. I mean, you can't get cheaper than that. Look at cabbage, what, $1 a pound? There's some of the red cabbage, some of the healthiest foods out there. Eating healthy can be convenient. What could be more? Anyone who doesn't think you can eat healthy and convenient has never met an apple before or a banana. I mean, it's just, you can eat convenient, cheap. I mean, you know, look, you can spend all the time you want to make some kind of gourmet meal, but there's lots of resources on eating inexpensive. In fact, there's a book called Eating Vegan on $4 a Day, yeah. Something like that. I mean, you know, and it's just, and it shows that, you know, if you want to eat healthy, you can do it at any socioeconomic level.
We're going to try to get as many questions as we can. They've been coming in fast and furious, so we're going to try to move quickly. Karen writes, could the speakers address any emerging research on dietary impact on dementia? Dr. Greger.
Yes, there's a study showing that patients with Alzheimer's randomized to cardiovascular risk reduction, such as lowering blood pressure and cholesterol, can slow the progression of dementia. However, when it comes to Alzheimer's dementia, there is no known way to reverse, just slow down progression.
Okay. Joy writes to us, Evan, thanks for the show. A question for the doctors. Is there statistical data that autoimmune disease can be reversed by this diet? I'm in my late 30s and was just diagnosed with I think it's Sjogren's syndrome, and I'm hoping to avoid taking medication for the rest of my life. I switched to a mostly plant-based diet several years ago, but found it a bit difficult to incorporate whole grains while avoiding processed foods such as breads. Any suggestions?
There are remarkable benefits for a number of autoimmune conditions, including ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis. These are the diseases most that we have the most evidence showing are effective, and we think it's because plant-based diets are anti-inflammatory diets, in some cases working as good or better than the leading drug classes in terms of reducing inflammation and improving kind of mobility in people with some of these inflammatory arthritis conditions. Unfortunately, there's very little data on Sjogren's and diet, but a healthy diet can only help. And look, if you already have one condition, I mean, the last thing you need is some other disease, so eating healthy can support your body during whatever treatments one might be taking.
Okay. Ted, you want to add anything there?
We recommend trying an elimination diet. It's certainly nothing to lose. You know, try 30 days of a very restricted plant-based diet. And there, if you go to PCRM.org, you can see what that diet is.
Yes. All right, one more quick question. John from Henrietta says, a recent Dr. Oz show, he said, showed the facts in corn-fed beef versus grain-fed beef. Grain-fed beef extracts are yellow and loaded with large amounts of beneficial omega-3s, while corn-fed beef extracts produce a thick, white, lard-like fat. Because Dr. Oz show is often a series of infomercials, is there anything to this, quote, information from John?
Well, I think when you talk about...
I think it's grass-fed versus...
Right, I think they're talking about
grass-fed versus corn-fed.
Right. Well, so, one of the concerns about meat consumption is the saturated fat content. Eating, you know, venison or wild-caught meat or grass-fed meat has lower levels of that, of saturated fat, and so would have a smaller adverse effect on one's cholesterol. But there are studies actually comparing the two. For example, a famous Australian study compared kangaroo meat, which is kind of the venison of Australia, to conventional meat and found a smaller bump of inflammation caused by the wild meat compared to conventional meat. But why suffer any bump of inflammation at all by eating an anti-inflammatory whole plant food diet?
Okay. And Ted, real quick here. Sure. They want to come see him 4:30 and 7:30 today. What's going on?
So at 4:30 and 7:30 today at the Rochester Academy of Medicine, 1441 East Avenue, Dr. Michael Greger, who's our guest on the show today, will be speaking on the role of diet in preventing, arresting, and reversing the leading causes of death. And you can buy tickets at rocklifemed.com. That's R-O-C-L-I-F-E-M-E-D.
RockLifeMed.com.
Right.
If you want to get tickets to see Dr. Greger, the book is called How Not to Die. You can pick it up now. I didn't even get a chance to ask you what you ate for breakfast. That's one of my favorite questions for people coming on this. I didn't even get a chance to ask you about garlic, why we're supposed to wait 10 minutes after crushing it before cooking it. I guess you have to find them online. What's the website is nutritionfacts.org. And the book is How Not to Die. It's great to have you here. Thank you so much for your time here.
Thanks. So glad to be here.
Thanks, Dr. Barnett. Thank you as well.
Pleasure. Thank
you. You see, when you're here, what you do to our phone lines, you wear them out, Ted. Great having you here. Our thanks to Valabanka, the engineer, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson, and thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.